Let's put in perspective the land of the Perryman Ranch at one time, one of the biggest in the Creek Nation. It extended from 21st to 71st Streets and from the Arkansas River to Lynn Lane and Broken Arrow. Would that be accurate?
This was not a matter of ownership. This was a matter of usage, because this was still when this was under tribal title. All the tribal members had an equal ownership in the 6.5 million acres before the Civil War, which was reduced to 3.25 million acres after the Civil War. But you were entitled to use what you could use that no one else was using. So if you had a home, nobody could take it away from you. If you fenced off a garden, nobody could take that away from you. It was a matter of not only of usage, but prior usage. The Perrymans and the families they were related to and the families they were friends with, they would run these huge herds of cattle. And like I said, they'd run them all the way out to Choteau, where the tribal boundary ended. They'd run them all the way down to Mounds on Duck Creek. And the only way to tell them apart was by whose brand was on which cow. But the Perrymans had dozens of men who worked for them as ranch hands and helped manage those herds. George Perryman was an important man in selling cattle, and as a matter of fact, was on a business trip into Kansas regarding sale of cattle when he died in 1898 or 1899.
Because there were so many Perrymans that all settled together, they all got an allotment, and that's what made them appear then to be fairly wealthy. And you had a great leader in George to manage all this? Is that the way this worked?
The Creeks were wealthy for their time, each and every one of them. Even the ones that would live in simple cabins or simple households, they knew no hunger. They could farm or orchard or ranch as much land as they could. They were an extremely prosperous people before their lands were divided up into individual allotments, and that was what really broke the tribal economy.
Not all tribes were as successful, apparently, with their land. I mean, to manage all of this together, I don't think the other tribes that came here were doing
because
that, were they?
The Muscogee had a tradition of communal life. Each town was like a great big commune. And yes, individual families would have their own gardens where they would raise whatever they wanted to, but the town itself would also have large communal fields where everyone in the town was obligated to help at time of planting, during the weeding during the summer, and at time of harvest. Angie DeBow describes some of these communal farms on the Canadian River, which would stretch for miles because the soil was so rich.
Weren't the Creeks one of the earliest to attach themselves to a town, where some of the other tribes didn't do that?
The tradition of Muscogee towns is so ancient. One of the authors of a report for the United States Interior Department back in the 1930s calls the Muscogee tribal town the oldest polity in North America, the oldest civic political institution in North America.
Robert, I want to ask you something. Down by Salisaw, I think, Spiral Mounds. I heard that man that runs that talk, and I guess at one time that was a huge, huge area of people.
They were obviously part of the overall Southeastern culture. Mm-hmm. A lot of the cultural artifacts there are not only nearly identical to some of the ones that would be found at Etowah, Georgia, or Moundville, Alabama, or some of the large prehistoric centers like that. Some of the artwork on those objects is so identical that they think some of the objects found in those three places were actually made by a single person. There's also an old Muscogee tradition that I have never been able to find out a lot about, but it talks about a town called Arbica in the west. Exactly how far west that might have been, no one really knows, but Arbica is one of our most significant towns among the Muscogee. It's one of the original migration towns of the Muscogee, and they still keep a ceremonial ground today down south of Henrietta.
Didn't people from around the world visit the ranch with all the activities that went on? This was a hubbub of activity.
When the National Governors Conference came to Tulsa, they had an event out here. We've had all kinds of events for some of Tulsa's major businesses like Williams Company and Hilti and many, many, many others. During the Depression, this was an important place for the local people. During the Dust Bowl days, this was one of the few wells that never went dry, and local people from the neighborhood would come here and pull water from the well.
Yeah, I can remember them coming up here to this well when there wasn't any water anywhere else and bringing these big barrels and filling them up with water.
And that well stands there to this day.
Mm-hmm.
It's right outside this house.
Right.
There was a rail line that served the Glenpool oil field that ran across the back of the property for a while. There was a schoolhouse up here on the corner, not very far from here. This was always a very important part of the center of the community out here in South Tulsa.
The discovery of oil, the Glenpool, in 1905, that really energized the area and, boom, sent Tulsa into the major growth.
Absolutely.
Since the Glenpool was not that far away, you would think that on all this acreage of the Perrimans, there would be oil as well. Did they attempt that?
Oh, yeah. There's still a functioning oil well right out here outside the front door. There's another one not too very far over the fence where the cattle are.
Across the creek over here, there's three wells, I think, right now.
When I was growing up and we'd stay out here, you would hear the clatter and clunk as that oil well right out here outside the door would just constantly run. And that's one of the few strange feelings I have when I come out here now, is it's too quiet. I don't hear that clatter and clunk that was here when I was a kid.
It kind of went deep, deep, and then it made it deem, and then deep, deep, deem. It is now dry. I don't know if they haven't tried to do anything to it.
I think they cycle it.
So did the Perrimans sell leases, or were the Perrimans benefactors of these wells that you just talked about?
Yes, they were the mineral owners. It was more that the oil companies would come in and offer to lease the land.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the money
go out and peddle the land. If they thought there was a prospect of finding oil on your land, they would come to you.
And you'd sell the lease.
Right.
So there's still a lease on this land. Sunoco, I think, is the one that has this, and I don't remember who has the other two. Different people has changed hands.
Well, at its peak, this ranch, I'm told, had like 15,000 cattle, a couple thousand horses, 1,200 wranglers.
Yeah, George Perryman's operation did. Absolutely. It was huge. Add to that the fact that Josiah and Legus, his brothers, his cousins, people like the Porters and some of the other families that were closely related to the Perryman, all of them would have cattle in that herd. And like I said, when it was time to separate them, you knew them apart by the brand that they had on their hind end.
And in 1880, they shipped more than 10,000 bushels each of corn and wheat. I mean, this was prosperous land.
This was prosperous land. And like I said, before the Civil War, this was America's breadbasket. What we think of as Kansas and Nebraska today were still occupied by tribes that owned all that land at Taz.